Liberia's civil war has created more than 1 million refugees. And the new Goodman Theater play, Objects in the Mirror, tells the story of one man trying to start a new life in Australia.
I've always felt that the artist is responsible for putting up a mirror to society and saying, this is what we are.
Plus, a Rockford High School basketball team's loss in the sectional finals had fans and coaches upset because the predominantly black team said there was racial bias from white referees. We'll look at some research on racial bias in basketball officiating. But first, the Atlantic cover story, My Family Slave, tells the story of a Filipina who spent her life raising someone else's family, all without pay. It's gotten lots of people talking. Today, we're checking in with two Filipino Americans in Illinois for their reaction. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Eudocia Thomas-Polito was 18 when she started working for the Tizon family in the Philippines. For more than 50 years, she cooked, cleaned, and took care of that family even after they relocated to the U.S. And for pretty much almost all of that time, all the way up until she passed away 6 years ago, she wasn't paid. This story is part of a heartbreaking June cover story in The Atlantic by the late writer Alex Tizon called My Family's Slave. It came out last week, and it's got lots of people, especially among our Asian community, talking about workers' rights, class inequality, and modern-day slavery in the U.S. I'm joined now by two guests to help us unpack this uniquely American and Filipino story. Michael Aguilar is Executive Director of the Alliance for Filipinos for Immigrant Rights and Empowerment, and Ana Guevara is an Associate Professor and Director of the Global Asian Studies Program at UIC. Michael, Ana, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla.
Thanks very much for having us.
Yeah, this is such a tough story. I feel like I have to start by saying, and by the way, of course, all of you who are listening, especially if you've heard the story, you want to weigh in, you're always welcome to join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. Ana, you know, this has struck such a chord with so many people, not just in the Filipino community. I've seen so many conversations among different Asian Americans. It's a complicated story. There's so much cultural nuance here, and it's a really tough story to read. So I just wanted to start by asking, what was your initial reaction when you read this story?
I think initially it was, of course, sadness that Eudocia Thomas-Polito was not able to tell her story and that Tizon is always going to be the conduit for her voice. But I was also, I became very worried that her story is somehow going to be represented as an exception when, for me and perhaps for many others, this is a very common story in the Philippines, in the U.S., and actually in many highly industrialized countries.
I was going to say, in many countries, right. This is unique to just the Philippines. There's lots of countries where people have these sort of domestic arrangements where people end up being enslaved. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Michael, what about you? What was your reaction?
Yeah. I think my reaction similarly was, intense sadness. And maybe it was because of the nickname that the family had given Thomas-Polito with of Lola, which is a very, it translates into grandma, but it has such a deeper emotional feeling and an attachment. And so I couldn't help but imagine the thousands of other Lolas and the two Lolas who helped raise me. And so kind of sadness transformed though into confusion, because throughout the story we heard Tizon's voice and so very little from Lola, and so I was searching for how her story could be told and where that story is being told, and it just isn't being found, and it's very rare to come across it even on the internet now.
So in this particular story, this woman is given to the writer's mother when she's 12 years old. They're both 12 years old, and she's essentially given to her as a slave. And she's with her whole life. When the family moves to the U.S., when she gets married, And then she ends up raising, you know, this writer and his three children, and it's sort of this secret that they keep. Anna, can you just sort of, I wonder if you can maybe, can you describe for us sort of, that's that story, the practice of having domestic caregivers in the Philippines and how Eudosia or Lola wound up in this situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is such an important question, sort of, you know, getting to the cultural context, because, I mean, as many of us know, the Philippines was a colony of Spain for 300 years. And part of the legacy of that colonization is the kind of feudal patriarchal economy that kind of systematized the system of servitude. I mean, not to say that this did not exist in pre-colonial Philippines, but it really became exacerbated in the advent of the Spanish colonization, kind of set up this master-servant paradigm that became pervasive, the value of women really, you know, as an equal to men, who belong to men, and that, you know, women are really became relegated in the domestic sphere. I think all of that culminated in creating this system of servitude where the only opportunities then left for women became is domestic work. And women became sort of this, just property of the feudal lords to be kind of exchanged and to serve families to maintain their households. So I think that is at the crux of her story, which makes it really, you know, kind of the basis for why we continue to see domestic work as kind of, you know, one of the only means of livelihood for many women in the Philippines. And the country, the state, has relied on this for many years, for centuries.
I just want to correct something that I said earlier. Lola was 18 when she was given to Tizon's mom, and she was 12 at that point. But Anna, so when people read the story, I think especially people who are not familiar with this practice, I think part of the shock is that this is happening right now. I mean, would you say that how common is this now today, these stories?
Oh, unfortunately, it is very common. What is uncommon is that
the story is actually being shared.
The story came out and
right.
that it became visible in this particular way.
And then and that the word slave was used, right? Because I think that's a really important part of this conversation, too, that we actually we're using the word slave as opposed to all of these other words.
Yeah, I mean, I think we also have to be very careful that, you know, using the word slavery has a very particular nuance in the U.S. And so there is in many ways, and I think it was Vicente Rafael came out with an excellent piece that sort of makes that distinction between, you know, U.S. slavery and also the kind of servitude that many domestic workers are serving under. But I think what is helpful and what I appreciate in actually using that term is that it does have resonance with the kind of, you know, the working conditions that many domestic workers face, the enslavement to their employers, the kind of isolation, the treatment as properties. So I think there is that resonance, but it's also important to remind ourselves that U.S. slavery has a very particular nuance that makes it different than what it might be happening with. What is happening with domestic workers, worldwide?
Yeah, thanks for making that point, too. Anna, Michael, can I ask you, you mentioned the word Lola, and you said you had Lolas in your life, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. I remember growing up, my parents petitioned my grandma to come over on my dad's side to essentially take care of us. So in a lot of ways, she was the one who sent us off to school. She was the one who cooked meals for us. She did laundry. She took care of my younger sibling when he was a baby. And then as I got older, my Lola on my mother's side was always a fixture in our house. She was always the one who would pray and lead the prayers in our home every week. We would take care of her. We would bring her to church. We would take her to the doctor. And she was very much the maternal figure inside our home. And in spite of having our parents, it was kind of Lola's word that at the end of the day, whenever she said something, we kind of all had to
fall in line.
Yeah. And there's a lot of authority that the matriarch in the family has, and over the domestic space, as Dr. Guevara said. And so I think that's also part of what hit a lot of people in our community, is this kind of emotional familial relationship that folks have with their lolas and people who work inside our homes to take care of our children, to take care of our parents when they get older, and ultimately us.
And I want to ask, Michael, what reactions you are hearing, not just from Filipino Americans maybe who were born and raised here, but maybe for people who've recently come from the Philippines?
Yeah. So some of the domestic workers we work with, we have been asking them their reactions. A lot of them haven't even read it, but when we talk about the issue, they're like, this is well known.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is common. And they see this all the time. Like, they see it in the Philippines when they were growing up, and in spite of even middle class or even poor people in the Philippines, they themselves had kutulongs or helpers inside the house and maids to do laundry, to cook the food, because they saw it as, well, I'm providing a job. They don't have any other kind of education. They come from a rural area. They wouldn't have any other opportunities if not for my generosity. And so when some of those folks immigrate to the U.S. and find that the employment environment is very difficult, and the only few jobs that they know and that our community knows is domestic work, I think it's a reminder of this class system and this lower status that they, wait a minute, I employed maids and helpers in the Philippines, and now I'm the maid myself here in the U.S. And so that kind of cognitive shift creates a lot of shame and prevents in our work from empowering those workers to claim their rights as workers and to say that you're entitled to minimum wage, you're entitled to these basic worker protections. And so a lot of times it's similar to Lola in that the workers here, they see it, they experience it, they experience the exploitation, but they don't want to cause trouble. They don't want to get anyone in trouble. They don't want to get in trouble themselves. They don't want to be deported.
Right. I was going to say sometimes there's questionable immigration issues.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that said, Michael, I'm thinking about your day job as executive director of Alliance of Filipinos for Immigrant Rights and Empowerment. From that context, like from a professional context, what does this story mean? Like, do you think that this story, as tough as it is, may be empowering?
In a professional sense, I see it as a powerful example of the importance of the Lolas in our community, the Tomas Politos, to tell their own story, to have the agency and the power to tell it themselves instead of having someone else tell it for them. And ultimately to find a community and to find resources outside of the kind of domestic space. We saw with Tomas Polito that she was very much isolated, that she wasn't connected to anybody. She didn't know anyone else. She wasn't allowed to drive. She didn't have any kind of valid immigration status. And so I'm curious on what it would have been like if she had been connected, or if someone else had seen what happened and connected her to some resources or reported something that happened, and was able to find a community of people to give her resources and to share her experience to see that she's not alone and she's not isolated.
And in that sense, Anna, I wanted to ask you, I feel like Filipinos and Filipino Americans are not normally, there's not much American immediate attention to the Filipino American community. Does it feel really strange to have so many people, so much attention on the community, especially because of such a painful story like this?
I mean, I think it's, I guess it's not so strange. I do understand that, I mean, in terms of sort of, issues around shame and, the kinds of stories you want to tell about ourselves. I think what I have just been thinking about also in kind of reflecting around my community's response to it and what I'm reading is that it's I think it's important to remember this is not necessarily just a story about Filipino Americans or about our community, whatever that may mean. I think it is a story about, you know, a larger system of inequality and exploitation that exists and continue to be, you know, pervasive, you know, worldwide. So it is, you know, as much as, you know, Lola's story, and I also actually react in the same way that Michael reacts to the name, I also don't want to refer to her as just Lola, because she isn't. She is Eudocia Tomas Pulido, who, you know, lived this particular, you know, life of servitude, but her story connects to a number of women, many of whom Michael works with, I work with, I've worked with, and they all have, you know, a common thread, and that they're connected, her story is connected to so many different axes, and, you know, I think it would be helpful to kind of remind ourselves that it is a bigger story. It is a story larger than just our, you know, our community.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think that's a good place to end, because we are unfortunately out of time. But I do want to thank Anna Guevara, Director and Associate Professor of the Global Asian Studies Program at the University of Illinois Chicago, for joining us. Michael Aguiar as well. He's Executive Director of the Alliance for Filipinos for Immigrant Rights and Empowerment. We will, of course, if you haven't read the story, we've tweeted out all the links. There's tons of think pieces about it, lots of conversation. Michael, Anna, thank you so much for helping us understand a little bit more of the context behind this. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
Yeah. Thank you, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering knowledge in its disciplines by recruiting and retaining library faculty, researchers, and thought leaders with deep subject matter knowledge and expert librarianship. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. More than 1 million refugees were displaced from Liberia during that country's civil wars decades ago. And the story of one of those refugees and his family's journey from their home to various refugee camps and eventually to Australia is the topic of a new play at Chicago's Goodman Theater. In the midst of our current national conversation about refugees, asylum, and who's able to receive that now in the United States, Objects in the Mirror is a powerful play inspired by a real-life refugee. It had its world premiere at the Goodman earlier this month. It's on through June 4th. The director of that play, which is Goodman's resident director, Chuck Smith, is here with me at the Medill Studios in downtown Chicago, along with the play's lead actor, Daniel Kyrie. Daniel, Chuck,
good morning.
Welcome to the 21st. Thank you. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Smith, how did you come across this play? Can you tell me the story of that?
Well, my good friend, playwright Charles Smith. He is my favorite playwright, and whenever he writes something that he thinks I might be interested in, he'll pass it on to me, and he passed this one on to me in its rough form, and I said, yeah, I think this is something we could get it, we could work on, and we put the play through our New Stages program, which is a workshop program where we actually stage it in front of an audience, you know, and get feedback and that kind of thing, and that happened a couple of years ago. And Charles went back and refined the play, reworked it, and then the Goodman, we all decided that we should do it on our main stage, and here we are.
I want to get back to the New Stages and that workshopping process in a minute, but I want to ask you, what were your first thoughts when you read the script the first time?
I thought it was an important play, basically. It's something that should be done. What it did for me is it put a face on the refugee. We talk about refugees all the time, but we don't know any, at least I didn't. And all of a sudden, here I am, you know, very much involved with this man, young man and his family. And seriously involved and, you know, really wanting to know what's going to happen to him. that's what it did for me. And I says, you know what? This is what I think this is. It's important because our audience should know something about the refugee, not just the refugee situation, but who is a refugee? What do they go through?
And I think the play does that in such a visceral way. Before we get into that, Daniel, for you, I wonder, what were your first thoughts when you read the script and you first met the character that you play, Shedrick Yarkpai? Is it Yarkpai?
Yarkpai.
Yarkpai.
Yeah. The thing that the play does for me that I think is really powerful and important, and that the story does, is that we spend time with this one particular family, this one family that's going through, you know, this thing that many refugees go through. But what it does is it invites us into, like, their story, their joys, their pains, like, their complexities, and it ties us into the very human nature of these crises, which we don't often get to engage with, I think, like reading headlines or, you know, watching things in the news. There is a sort of distance that is there, and this brings us so much closer to being able to develop empathy and be able to put ourselves into the shoes of others. And I think that that's what the play does so well. And the sort of gravity of getting to portray, you know, this character is the fact that it is, you know, he is a real person. He's living and breathing in the world today. It has swept the rug out from under me in a way. Like, it's very sobering to know a human being, a person who has gone through everything that he's gone through and is still this person that's capable of smiling or cracking a joke or, you know, sending me well wishes. It's just so, yeah, it's so crazy, but that's the reality.
Yeah, and that's the thing, Chuck. There's this line at the beginning of the play where Shedrick says, and of course this sort of proves to be like the very most important line of, or at least sort of the foreshadowing of the play, right? Because he says, knowing the names of things are important. And I think back, Chuck, to your career at the Goodman and the plays that you specifically, what you do, your work, bringing voice to people, bringing voice to stories, providing a historical context or stories of which we don't often hear or get lost. And I wanted to ask you why you thought that line, that concept is so important to you.
Well, on a funny tip, I thought you was going to take it to the fact that Charles Smith and Chuck
right,
Smith.
Right, well, that too. There's all names, you know, thing, right?
Names,
let's make that clear. Yeah. You're Chuck Smith, there's Charles Smith. It's two different people,
yeah,
right?
Right.
And but I was going a little more philosophical.
Yeah, I know.
You
both,
go either way.
We
though.
Both grew up in the city of Chicago. We both
right.
in theater. And, you know, we get mixed up all the time.
Right.
You know,
so your
yeah.
names are important.
Our names are very important.
In front
important,
of me
know.
Is resident director of the Goodman Theater, Chuck Smith.
Chuck Smith.
Not Chicago playwright Charles Smith, who also wrote this. Let's
right.
get that clear.
Yeah. But the names of things, especially for this young man, Shedrick, by the way, like Daniel was saying, he's a real life guy. And this play came forth because of the fact that one of Charles's plays was done in Australia, and Charles went to Australia to see this play, and Shedrick was an actor in the play, and Shedrick told Charles his story, and Charles was overwhelmed, and that's how this play came about. But the fact that Shedrick had to, you know, go through many many experiences on his way to where he is now in Australia, and things had to be done, and he kind of lost track of who he was. And finding himself and getting back to who he was very important to him. And that's the core of what this play is about. It's not only is it the story of refugees, but it's the story of a young man finding himself, and which is, like you say, one of the most important aspects of the play. At the end of the play, Shedrick knows who he is.
And I think knowing who he is, we come to know him through this. And I wonder for both of you, you talked about sort of the experience of a refugee. And I think that's something we see in headlines. You know, maybe we're reading different accounts. I think for me, what was most fascinating about this is in the play, the details as Shedrick is recounting what life is like in these refugee camps, because he's in a couple of them. They spend years in these camps. Daniel, how did you prepare for that? How did you prepare to sort of get in the mindset of someone, you know, knowing his real life story and being able to express that on the stage?
For me, I feel like I tap into things in a couple different ways. Images are very effective for me personally, and so in having so much knowledge and access at our fingertips now, the things that we can kind of, I essentially started a diet before I start like a play, and it's more than just food. It's also the things that I'm consuming, the types of media that I'm consuming, and you know, movies or documentaries or just sort of like YouTube clips of like Liberian politicians speaking, and just to put my mind there a little bit are things that I like to do. But I mean, ultimately it comes down to empathy and the ways that we find ourselves getting closer to empathizing with another human being. And that's where direction and the writing and all of those things kind of come into play, because I mean, this, just honestly speaking, like this play is just a really good play. And so the most important thing that for me, like feeling like I couldn't go into it feeling like I had to capture this particular human being, Shedrick. I had to go in and be like, this is a play, this is a character, and start there. And like, what are the truths of like this person? What do they want? Like, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that more than anything helped me get closer to who Shedrick is. Just paying attention as much as possible to what's, on the page, and the honesty of what the other actors and characters are giving me as well.
Right, because Chuck, how do you direct that too? And I'm thinking even of the sets, which are very simple but very powerful also. You know, when Shedrick is describing sort of being in the refugee camps, you kind of have a different, very interesting kind of audiovisual background of a,
But believe it or not, that's all in addition to the fact that it is a good play.
Right.
It's
good, very powerful,
well-written play. And that's Charles Smith. Charles Smith is an extremely good writer.
So then how does Chuck Smith, the director, direct a play like that, though?
Well, I approach it pretty much the same way all plays. And I immerse myself in the world of the play. Unlike Daniel, who says, he goes on a diet of information, I go on a diet of strictly the words in the play, because that's all an audience is going to get, basically. So I have to make sure that everything written in the play is clear, crystal clear, and I understand every word so that I can help an audience digest each and every one of these words. And then everything else surrounds the words.
The sets, by the way, are lovely. The opening scene.
That's which is my favorite, of course.
Right, I love it's a lovely favorite. Set of the ocean.
Yeah. It's a beautiful play to watch, in spite of the horrors that you're going through. Sitting there watching the play is amazing, just simply amazing. My Ricardo Hernandez, who I work with a lot, especially when on anything that deals with projections, just like about Frith collaboration, and John Colvert, my lighting designer, they've come up with some gorgeous imagery for this play.
It's gorgeous. It's very simple. It's very stark, like the play. And I wanted to ask you all. The Goodman is doing an Artists in Action series next week about talking about immigration and asylum. And that was the moment for me. There's a scene where Shedrick and his uncle are talking about getting prepared for an interview, for their asylum interview, and they're rehearsing all the questions and they're rehearsing the answers, and they're talking about how nervous they are about this interview. And in my head, I just kept thinking about extreme vetting, and I just kept thinking about all the conversations we've been having in this country about refugees and whether we're vetting them properly, and listening to the story of these two who had been waiting 2 years for their interview and 2 years for a process before they get interviewed by the U.S. Chuck, how much did you think about that? How much did you think about Syria and Syrian refugees and all of that conversation we're having now?
I didn't. I thought about this family.
Okay, you that's didn't.
I didn't.
Interesting.
That's what this family is not concerned about, Syria.
Right.
This family is thinking about what they're dealing with right now.
Right.
Their situation right now. It did. I couldn't allow myself to think about all the other situations in Syria or anywhere else except for this Liberian family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all they're thinking about. I don't think they're thinking about the Syrians at this
right.
point.
Right, mm-hmm. yeah.
You know, so, hey, I got to think
about
it. Daniel,
did you think
about that? Just trying to survive.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that all of that stuff crosses my mind, like, going into it, because, I mean, when we are addressing, like, this subject matter, I can't help but draw parallels to what's happening. And like I was saying earlier, like, the kinds of access that we have to so much information and knowledge or whatever on my timeline, you know what I mean, pretty much any time I log online, like, these are things, you know,
you're
the
seeing
notifications
all these stories.
That yeah. I get. You can't help but see, you know, all the stories and the videos, you know what I mean, the awful,
yeah,
like, videos. And so that's stuff that has, like, entered my head as well. And I mean, I definitely have opinions about, like, what we are sort of what it seems like we are sort of moving towards as a country, that it doesn't necessarily put the human beings first.
Yeah,
which
and I wonder
is,
that
know,
for both of you as two Americans who are doing this play, did it change? Did it make you think differently about our national kind of conversation about this?
Well, I've always felt that the artist is responsible for putting up a mirror to society and saying, this mm-hmm. is what we are. This is what's going on. And you have to take a look at this. Now, whether you like what you see or not, mm-hmm. that's we can't help that. But this is what's going on. And so that is the responsibility as me as an artist, you know, to be honest about, hey, this is the real deal. Boom. I'm not saying how I feel about it. I'm telling you this is what's going on. Mm-hmm. And you have to take it or leave it. But this is the real.
One last quick question for you. We're almost out of time. What's been the reaction from the actual Shedrick to this play, to having its world premiere?
He loves it. We Skyped him in the day before we opened, and had and he had the audience in tears. You know, when the few stories that he told about his life, and like Daniel was saying, he's a regular guy. You know, and he's been through all of this crap, you know. But, you know, and then, but Charles, one of Charles' stories is that, you know, these kids right here on the streets of Chicago are going through a lot of mm-hmm. crap. You know, mm-hmm. they're going through a lot of stuff too, you know. And Cedric traveled, you know, thousands of miles to get to Australia. And Charles said he traveled all the way around the world to get from the south side to get to the north side.
Yeah.
So, you know, it gives you a lot of food for thought, you know. So, yeah, this play makes you think.
This play does make you think. It's Objects in the Mirror. It's on at the Goodman Theater in Chicago through June 4th. Daniel Kyrie in his Goodman debut. Congratulations on that, by the way,
thank
Daniel.
You.
I want to thank Daniel, resident director of the Goodman, Chuck Smith, for being with me. Objects in the Mirror, you can see it through June 4th. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me.
Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
The The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
To the 21st, Nyla Boodoo. Earlier this year, the Rockford East girls basketball team's best season in school history came to an end. The team lost to Boylan Catholic High School in the sectional finals, but it was how they lost that had many fans and coaches upset. Boylan, a predominantly white team, shot three times as many free throws during the game than Rockford East, a predominantly black team. Head coach L.A. Malone raised questions about the all-white officiating crew and questioned whether racial bias was a factor in the loss. Racial bias when calling fouls is something researchers have questioned for years throughout all levels of basketball. In a 2007 National Bureau of Economic Research study found that, quote, more personal fouls are called against players when they're officiated by an opposite race refereeing crew than when officiated by an own race crew, and how much that impacts the game. Later, we're going to be joined by one of the researchers behind that study to talk more about that. But first, joining me now is L.A. Malone, head coach of Rockford East girls basketball team. L.A., thanks for taking time to talk with me on the 21st. Welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Can you tell me what happened in that game against Boylan back in February?
Oh, man, dear. you pretty much summed it up. I mean, they shot 37 free throws. They hit 30 out of 37 free throws. And we shot 10. We went 6 for 10. So each team, you know, hit a high percentage of their free throws. But when you outshoot a team, you know, 27 free shots in a sectional championship game with the type of teams that these, you know, us and Boylan were this year, that just, like you said, it raised a lot of questions. It really does, so.
And so do you feel
that's basically what happened, but yeah. It was a really exciting game. And, you know, like I said, they shot 37 free throws. So,
you feel like your girls were being called? Yeah. Do you feel like your girls were getting called for more fouls? Like you felt like it was unfair?
Yes.
You've played ball all the way up to semi-pro level. Would you say that you feel like this is a common thing? Maybe this happens that there's some kind of implicit bias against black players.
Yeah, I feel it's an implicit bias, but it's something. The reason I say implicit, what I mean by that is, you know, sometimes people don't realize, you know, they're doing it as well. So, you know, I know we do play, you know, bring race into it and all that, and. You know, I wouldn't say, you know, a particular person is racist unless I absolutely know them. So most of the refs, you know, that ref our games are Caucasian referees. And, you know, a handshake and hello, how you doing? And some may even, you know, bring up a conversation with me. So I wouldn't say that they're, you know, racist in that term, like, you know, old school racist, black and white drinking fountain, things like that. But, you know, just an implicit a biased thing that's, you know, not necessarily conscious that they're aware of. And it just, you know, I mean, it comes out when you break down the numbers and the stats. And like you said, the studies that's been shown, I mean, documentation beat conversation. So,
right. You know. And when you say that too, coach, you know, the Rockford Register Star reported that just 14 of 65 Rockford basketball officials are black. Do you see that as part of the problem?
It could be. I don't see it as being, you know, sole part of the problem, but, you know, on the girls' side too, you know, referee, just finding quality referees, that's kind of hard as well, as the referees are getting
of
older.
Of any color, right, yeah, right.
You know, of any color. So, you know, when you speak of the overall group, you know, you just can't channel it that. But according to our conversation today, you know, and the team and experiences that we've had, you know, it's been a really big issue.
Right. And I'm thinking about a men's high school basketball coach in East Chicago, Indiana. He made similar comments after his team lost to a controversial foul call late in the game. That coach, Pete Turgovich, he said he thought white officials cheated his mostly black team out of the win, and he questioned why a black ref had never officiated one of his team's games. Do you hear coaches talking? Do coaches talk about this?
Not publicly. That's probably where we at today. Yeah. They, you know, we don't talk about it. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And that's another thing. We just don't talk about it. And then, you know, as athletes and certain coaches and people, you know, you always, you know, as far as me, I teach adversity. So, you know, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, what happens to you. It's kind of what you do about it. So you kind of do that. But then, you know, when you take something away from kids, that's a hard lesson to learn. And,
yeah. What did you say to your team? What did you say to the girls after the loss?
And I just told them, I embraced them, told them I loved them. And, you know, they played a, man, really great season. You know, we try not to just harp on that game. So I really tried to paint the picture overall. Look what we've done, the history we've made. And, you know, and I really had a great group of girls. I'm talking about good people, respectful, polite. And I just told them, you know, your character will take you where your talent can't keep you. So 4 out of 5 of my girls already signed to go to college and play ball. You know, so that's that's priceless.
Yeah, that's priceless. So yeah, that's great.
Rung that home, you know.
I'm speaking with L.A. Malone. He's head coach of Rockford East girls basketball team. To help us understand a little bit more about the research, I wanted to bring someone else in this conversation. Joseph Price is an associate professor of economics at Brigham Young University, and he's one of the authors of that study that I was just talking about a little bit ago. Joseph, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what does the research say? What did you see when you looked at racial bias with NBA referees and calling fouls? What does the data show?
Well, so we'd done an earlier study where we showed there was racial bias in foul calls, and it was an own race bias. It just meant that white referees called fewer fouls on white players and black referees called fewer fouls on black players. And this study got a lot of media attention in May 2007. And so in this follow-up study, we just looked to see if it had an effect on the racial bias in the NBA, and it looks like the media attention basically made it go away almost right away.
Oh, interesting. So the fact that people started talking about it led to an actual change?
Yeah, it actually, it looks like the referees were a little slower to blow the whistle. So the number of fouls called actually dropped quite a bit. That was enough of a pause, it looks like, to have made the racial gaps go away.
And did the NBA play a role in trying to bring about change by addressing this issue? Or was this something that referees started policing themselves?
Well, I mean, we reached out to the NBA. They claimed that there was no racial bias there to begin with, and so there was no reason for them to do anything. But we think it operated largely through referees kind of learning about their own bias and then policing themselves.
Okay. And, you know, do you think that – is it something as – I don't want to say simple, but do you think the research suggests that being made aware – of racial bias is enough to bring about a change?
Well, I think it's part of a set of tools. The thing is, I think we've done a really good job at getting rid of explicit forms of racial bias, but all of us harbor stereotypes that affect the kind of small decisions we make every day. And so I think as we become aware of how those implicit biases affect our decisions, we can maybe do things to change.
So I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. We've been talking with L.A. Malone, the coach, Joseph Price, the researcher. Kirk Gibson is with us as well. He's on the line from Peoria. He's Associate Executive Director of IHSA. Hey, Kurt, thanks for joining our conversation as well. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Kurt, as you're listening to this conversation, I wonder, is the IHSA actively trying to recruit more minorities for officiating in basketball? I know it's tough as it is, it seems like, to get referees in general, but what do you guys think about this issue?
Well, I think nationally there's a shortage of officials in all sports. Yeah, we're trying and using every means we can to try and attract new officials to the avocation. You know, our numbers, our registration numbers are down. You know, I've been with the association now for 15 years, and there was a time when we would have licensed over 15,000 officials, and that's across all sports. This year, that number is down around 12,000. So it is getting harder and harder for state associations like ours to recruit and then retain officials after a period of time. So it's a very common challenge everybody's facing. And certainly, you know, we hope in through our promotional efforts that we're doing things in a way that attracts officials from all walks of life, all races and all genders to take on the avocation.
Yeah. Do you guys, is there diversity training that referees go through when they sign up to officiating games? What kind of training goes into getting certification from IHSA to ref games?
Yeah, getting an initial certification is going to involve completing an application. We'll do a background check on an official. We'll provide some training materials in the sports for which they register. We make available clinics, not only through our office directly, but through officials' associations, trying to help officials, you know, learn how to officiate the sports that they register for. And while part of that falls on our office in terms of making materials available, the lion's share of that really falls on officials' associations. They're the ones who are, you know, taking some of the promotional efforts we make, getting out into the streets, so to speak, of communities all around our state, and trying to attract people into their association where they can then take some of the initial work that we've done and expand on that through mentoring programs to try and help bring officials along.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, have you ever personally heard of any complaints to the IHSA about racial bias among referees?
It's very common that we get complaints during all kinds of sports in our postseason about various kinds of biases.
Mm,
you know, it's
okay.
Very common when someone loses a game, and especially in our postseason, that there are, you know, at least from one side of the issue, there are a lot of reasons why the team lost the game. And unfortunately, a lot of times it falls, you know, that finger of blame falls in the direction of the official. It might be because of the official's race. It might be because they aren't used to seeing a certain team or style of play. It could be that there was, you know, previous episodes with other schools in the same conference. I mean, there's any number of reasons why our office is contacted, and especially in the postseason, like I said, following a team's loss in any of our tournaments.
Sure. Coach, I wonder if you might weigh in. Do you feel like style of play, is that something that you think sometimes, I mean, all officiating is subjective, right? So I wonder what your thoughts are on that issue, Coach.
Like you said, that definitely plays a role when you got referees and maybe they might have seen a team out of that conference and, you know, they might feel a certain type of way and make certain calls. So it all, like I said, it is all a collective effort and a lot of things go into a game. But the highlight of it all is, like you said, in the postseason, you know, it's either win or go home. So sometimes
yeah, it makes it
people,
real tough.
You know, point to blame or, you know, they get complaints and it's kind of like, you know, where do they start? You know,
well,
so
Coach,
you really
we
just have to evaluate the complaints.
Yeah, we just have about a minute left, and I wonder if I could just let you offer what advice you'd like to see. You're one of the few people who's spoken out publicly about this. We did reach out to lots of different people to try to get them to talk about this on the air, and we had a real tough time, to be honest with you. So I wonder if I could let you have the last word and just think, what advice would you offer out there for either people who want to help recruit more minorities officiating, or what you want people who are training these referees to know?
It's kind of like the old school's concept, it takes a village to raise a child. So even on this conversation alone, I learned a lot of things. Those studies I weren't particularly aware of. So, you know, us being open and talking about it, and like you say, everybody evaluating themselves and kind of doing their own judge. I heard earlier we talked about the NBA. And see, it's more on the professional side with them. So, you know, they have to be aware of that type of thing and the extra training and things that they have to do to perfect their craft. And they also get fined, too. So bringing it down to our level, and when we bring in youth and the uplifting of our society and our communities, it just has to be a totally community, everybody-based effort. And we have to be willing to talk about it, too.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with us. It's L.A. Malone, head coach of the Rockford East girls basketball team. I want to thank Kurt Gibson from IHSA and Joseph Price, who teaches at BYU. All of you gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That does it for us today. I'm afraid we're out of time. We'll tweet out all those links, by the way, if you follow 21ST Show on Twitter, if you want to see more of that research. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.